You're listening to a recording from the Open Society Institute, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming. And also, I want to greet the students at MIT. Today, I'll apply the concepts introduced yesterday. Fallibility, reflexivity, and the human uncertainty principle into the financial markets. Please brace yourselves, because I'll pack a lifetime of experience into this one lecture. The financial markets provide an excellent laboratory for testing the ideas that I put forward in an abstract form yesterday. The course of events is easier to observe than in most other places. Many of the facts take a quantitative form, and the data are well recorded and well preserved. The opportunity for testing occurs because my interpretation of financial markets directly contradicts the efficient market hypothesis, which has been the prevailing theory about financial markets. That theory claims that markets tend towards equilibrium. Deviations occur in a random fashion and can be attributed to extraneous shocks. If that theory is valid, mine is false, and vice versa. Let me state the two cardinal principles of my conceptual framework as it applies to the financial markets. First, market prices always distort the underlying fundamentals. The degree of distortions may vary from the negligible to the significant. This is in direct contradiction to the efficient market hypothesis, which maintains that market prices accurately reflect all the available information. Second, instead of playing a purely passive role in reflecting an underlying reality, financial markets also have an active role. They can affect the so-called fundamentals that they are supposed to reflect. There are various pathways by which the mispricing of financial assets can occur. The most widely traveled are those which involve the use of leverage, both debt and equity leveraging. The various feedback loops may give the impression that markets are often right, but the mechanism at work is very different from the one proposed by the prevailing paradigm. I claim that financial markets have ways of altering the fundamentals, and that may bring about a closer correspondence between market prices and the underlying fundamentals. Contrast that with the efficient market hypothesis, which claims that markets are always accurately reflecting reality and automatically tend towards equilibrium. My two propositions focus attention on the reflexive feedback loops that characterize financial markets. There are two kinds of feedback, negative and positive. Negative feedback is self-correcting. Positive feedback is self-reinforcing. Thus, negative feedback sets up a tendency towards equilibrium, while positive feedback produces dynamic disequilibrium. Positive feedback loops are more interesting because they can bring about big moves, both in market prices and in the underlying fundamentals. A positive feedback process that runs its full course is initially self-reinforcing, but eventually it is liable to reach a climax or reversal point, after which it becomes self-reinforcing in the opposite direction. But positive feedback processes don't necessarily run their full course. They may be aborted at any time by negative feedback. I have developed a theory about boom-bust processes or bubbles along these lines. Every bubble has two components, an underlying trend that prevails in reality and a misconception relating to that trend. A boom-bust process is set in motion when a trend and a misconception positively reinforce each other. The process is liable to be tested by negative feedback along the way. If the trend is strong enough to survive the test, both the trend and the misconception will be further reinforced. Eventually, market expectations become so far removed from reality that people are forced to recognize that a misconception is involved. A twilight period ensues, during which doubts grow and more people lose faith, but the prevailing trend is sustained by inertia. As Chuck Prince, a former head of Citigroup, said, we must continue dancing until the music stops. Eventually, a point is reached when the trend is reversed. It then becomes self-reinforcing in the opposite direction. Let me go back to the example I used when I originally proposed my theory in 1987, the conglomerate boom of the late 1960s. The underlying trend is represented by earnings per share. The expectations relating to that trend by stock prices. So here you have the earnings per share and the stock prices. Conglomerates improve their earnings per share by acquiring other companies. Inflated expectations allowed them to improve their earnings performance, but eventually reality could not keep up with expectations. After a twilight period, the price trend was reversed. All the problems that had been swept under the carpet surfaced and earnings collapsed. As the president of one of the conglomerates, Ogden Corporation, told me at the time, I have no audience to play to. This is a model of the conglomerate bubble. The charts of actual conglomerates like Ogden Corporation closely resemble this chart. Bubbles that conform to this pattern go through distinct stages. There is the inception, then a period of acceleration, reinforced by successful tests when the price declines, but the trend reinforces is strong enough to reinforce itself. Then a twilight period ensues. And a reversal point or climax is reached, followed by an acceleration on the downside, culminating in a financial crisis. The length and strength of each stage is unpredictable, but there is an internal logic in the sequence of stages. So the sequence is predictable. But even that can be terminated by government intervention or some other form of negative feedback. In the case of the conglomerate boom, it was the defeat of Lisco in its attempt to acquire Manufacturers Hanover Trust that constituted the climax or reversal point. Typically, bubbles have an asymmetric shape. The boom is long and drawn out. Slow to start, it accelerates gradually until it flattens out during the twilight period. The bust is short and steep because it's reinforced by the forced liquidation of unsound positions. Disillusionment turns into panic, reaching its climax in a financial crisis. The simplest case is a real estate boom. The trend that precipitates it is that credit becomes cheaper and more easily available. The misconception is that the value of the collateral is independent of the availability of credit. As a matter of fact, the relationship between the availability of credit and the value of the collateral is reflexive. When credit becomes cheaper and more easily available, activity picks up and real estate values rise. There are fewer defaults, credit performance improves, and lending standards are relaxed. So at the height of the boom, the amount of credit involved is at its maximum, and a reversal precipitates forced liquidation, depressing real estate prices. Yet, this misconception continues to recur in various guises. For instance, the international banking crisis of 1982 revolved around sovereign debt, where no collateral is involved. The creditworthiness of the sovereign borrowers was measured by various debt ratios, like debt to GDP and debt service to exports. These ratios were considered objective criteria, while in fact they were reflexive. When the recycling of petrodollars in the 1970s increased the flow of credit to countries like Brazil, their debt ratios improved, encouraging further inflows and starting a bubble. Not all bubbles involve the extension of credit. Some are based on equity leveraging. The best examples are the conglomerate boom of the 1960s and the internet bubble of the late 1990s. When Alan Greenspan spoke about irrational exuberance in 1996, it misrepresented bubbles. When I see a bubble forming, I rush in to buy, adding fuel to the fire. That's not irrational. And that's why we need regulators to counteract the market when a bubble is threatening to grow too big, because we can't rely on market participants, however well-informed and rational they are. Bubbles are not the only form in which reflexivity manifests itself. They are only the most dramatic and the most directly opposed to the efficient market hypothesis. Therefore, they deserve special attention. But reflexivity can take many other forms. In currency markets, for instance, the upside and downside are symmetrical, so that there is no sign of an asymmetry between boom and bust. But there is no sign of equilibrium either. Freely floating exchange rates tend to move in large, multi-year waves. And the most important and most interesting reflexive interaction takes place between the financial authorities and financial markets. Because markets don't tend towards equilibrium, they are prone to produce periodic crises. Financial crises lead to regulatory reforms. That's how central banking and the regulation of financial markets have evolved. Both the financial authorities and market participants act on the basis of imperfect understanding, and that makes the interaction between them reflexive and unpredictable. While bubbles only occur intermittently, the interplay between authorities and markets is an ongoing process. Misunderstandings by either side usually stay within reasonable bounds because market reactions provide useful feedback to the authorities, allowing them to correct their mistakes. But occasionally, the mistakes prove to be self-validating, setting in motion vicious or virtuous circles. Such feedback loops resemble bubbles in the sense that they are initially self-reinforcing, but eventually self-defeating. But otherwise, they take quite a different shape. It's important to realize that not all price distortions are due to reflexivity. Market participants can't possibly base their decisions on knowledge. They have to anticipate the future, and the future is contingent on the decisions that people have not yet made. What those decisions are going to be and what effect they will have can't be accurately anticipated. Nevertheless, people are forced to make decisions. To guess correctly, people would have to know the decisions of all of the other participants and their consequences, but that's impossible. Rational expectations theory sought to circumvent this impossibility by postulating that there is a single correct set of expectations and people's views will converge around it. That postulate has no resemblance to reality, but it is the basis of financial economics as it's currently taught in universities. In practice, participants are obliged to make their decisions in conditions of uncertainty. Their decisions are bound to be tentative and biased. That's the generic cause of price distortions. Occasionally, the price distortions set in motion a boom-bust process. More often, they are corrected by negative feedback. In these cases, market fluctuations have a random character. I compare them to the waves sloshing around in a swimming pool as opposed to a tidal wave. Obviously, the latter are more significant, but the former are more ubiquitous. The two kinds of price distortions intermingle so that in reality, boom-bust processes rarely follow the exact course of my model. Bubbles that follow the pattern I described in my model occur only in those rare occasions when they are so powerful that they overshadow all the other processes going on at the same time. It will be useful to distinguish between near equilibrium and far from equilibrium conditions. The near equilibrium conditions are characterized by random fluctuations, and the far from equilibrium situations are those in which a bubble predominates. Near equilibrium is characterized by humdrum, everyday events which are repetitive and lend themselves to statistical generalizations. Far from equilibrium conditions give rise to unique historical events where outcomes are generally uncertain but have the capacity to disrupt the statistical generalizations based on everyday events. The rules that can guide decisions in near equilibrium conditions don't apply in far from equilibrium situations. The recent financial crisis is a case in point. All the risk management tools and synthetic financial products that were based on the assumption that price deviations from a putative equilibrium occur in a random fashion broke down. And people who relied on mathematical models, which had served them well in near equilibrium conditions, got badly hurt. I have gained some new insights into far from equilibrium conditions during the recent financial crisis. As a participant, I had to act under immense time pressure, and I couldn't gather all the information that would have been available. And the same applied to the regulatory authorities in charge. That's how far from equilibrium situations can spin out of control. And this is not confined to financial markets. I experienced it, for instance, during the collapse of the Soviet Union. The fact that the participants' thinking is time-bound instead of timeless is left out of account by rational expectations theory. I was aware of the uncertainty associated with reflexivity, but even I was taken in by, I was taken by surprise by the extent of the uncertainty in 2008. It cost me dearly. I got the general direction of the markets right, but I didn't allow for the volatility. As a consequence, I took on positions that were too big to withstand the swings caused by volatility, and several times I was forced to reduce my positions at the wrong time in order to limit my risk. I would have done much better if I had taken smaller positions and stuck with them. I learned the hard way that the range of uncertainty is also uncertain, and at times it can become practically infinite. Uncertainty finds expression in volatility. Increased volatility requires a reduction in risk exposure. This leads to what Keynes called increased liquidity preference. This is an additional factor in the forced liquidation of positions that characterize financial crises. When the crisis abates and the range of uncertainty is reduced, it leads to an almost automatic rebound in the stock market as the liquidity preference stops rising and eventually falls. That's another lesson that I have learned recently. I also need to point out that the distinction between near and equilibrium and near and far from equilibrium conditions that I've mentioned was introduced by me while trying to make some sense out of a confusing reality, and it doesn't accurately reflect reality. Reality is always more complicated than the dichotomies we introduce into it. The recent crisis is comparable to a 100-year storm. We have had a number of crises leading up to it. These are comparable to 5 or 10-year storms. Regulators who had successfully dealt with the smaller storms were less successful when they applied the same methods to the 100-year storms. These general remarks prepare the ground for a specific hypothesis I have put forward, to explain the recent financial crisis. It's not derived from my theory of bubbles by deductive logic. Nevertheless, the two of them stand or fall together. So here it goes. I contend that the puncturing of the subprime bubble in 2007 set off the explosion of a super bubble, much as an ordinary bomb sets off a nuclear explosion. The housing bubble in the United States was the most common kind, distinguished only by the widespread use of collateralized debt obligations and other synthetic instruments. Behind this ordinary bubble, there was a much larger super bubble growing over a longer period of time, which was much more peculiar. The prevailing trend in this super bubble was the ever-increasing use of credit and leverage. The prevailing misconception was the belief that financial markets are self-correcting and should be left to their own devices. President Reagan called it the magic of the marketplace, and I call it market fundamentalism. It became the dominant creed in the 1980s when Ronald Reagan was president of the United States and Margaret Thatcher was prime minister of the United Kingdom. What made the super bubble so peculiar was the role that financial crises played in making it grow. Since the belief that markets could be safely left to their own devices was false, the super bubble gave rise to a series of financial crises. The first and most serious was the international banking crisis of 1982. This was followed by many other crises, the most notable being the portfolio insurance debacle in October 1987, the savings and loan crisis that unfolded in various episodes between 1989 and 1994, the emerging market crisis of 1997-98, and the bursting of the internet bubble in 2000. Each time a financial crisis occurred, the authorities intervened, merged away or otherwise took care of the failing financial institutions, and applied monetary and fiscal stimulus to protect the economy. These measures reinforced the prevailing trend of ever-increasing credit and leverage, but as long as they worked, they also reinforced the prevailing misconception that markets can be safely left to their own devices. That was a misconception because it was the intervention of the authorities that saved the system. Nevertheless, these crises served as successful tests of a false belief, and as such, they inflated the super bubble even further. Eventually, the credit expansion became unsustainable and the super bubble exploded. The collapse of the subprime mortgage market led to the collapse of one market after another in quick succession, because they were all interconnected, the firewalls having been removed by deregulation. That's what distinguished this financial crisis from all those that preceded it. Those were successful tests that reinforced the process. The subprime crisis of 2007 constituted the turning point. The collapse then reached its climax with the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers, which precipitated the large-scale intervention of the financial authorities. It's characteristic of my boom-bust model that it can't predict in advance whether a test will be successful or not. This holds for ordinary bubbles as well as the super bubble. I personally thought that the emerging market crisis of 1997-98 would constitute the turning point for the super bubble, but I was wrong. The authorities managed to save the system, and the super bubble continued growing. That made the bust that eventually came in 2008 all the more devastating. After the bankruptcy of Lehman Brothers on September 15, 2008, the financial markets had to be put on artificial life support. This was a shock not only for the financial sector, but also for the real economy. International trade was particularly badly hit. But the artificial life support worked, and financial markets stabilized. The economy gradually revived. A year later, the whole episode feels like a bad dream, and people would like to forget it. There is a widespread desire to treat the crisis as just another crisis and return to business as usual. But reality is unlikely to oblige. The system is actually broken and needs to be fixed. My analysis offers some worthwhile clues to the kind of regulatory reform that's needed. First and foremost, since markets are bubble-prone, the financial authorities have to accept responsibility for preventing bubbles from growing too big. Alan Greenspan and others have expressly refused to accept that responsibility. If markets can't recognize bubbles, Greenspan asserted, neither can regulators. And he was right. Nevertheless, the financial authorities have to accept the assignment, knowing full well that they will not be able to meet it without making mistakes. They will, however, have the benefit of receiving feedback from the markets, which will tell them whether they have done too much or too little. They can then correct their mistakes. Second, in order to control asset bubbles, it's not enough to control the money supply. You must also control the availability of credit. This can't be done by using only monetary tools. You must also use credit controls. The best known tools are margin requirements and minimum capital requirements. Currently, they are fixed, irrespective of the market mood, because markets are not supposed to have moods. Yet they do, and the financial authorities need to vary margin and minimum capital requirements in order to control asset bubbles. Regulators may also have to invent new tools or revive ones that have fallen into disuse. For instance, in my early days in finance, many years ago, central banks used to instruct commercial banks to limit their lending to a particular sector of the economy, such as real estate or consumer loans, because they felt that the sector was overheating. Market fundamentalists consider that crass interference with the market mechanism, but they are wrong. Now, central banks used to do it. We had no financial crises to speak of. The Chinese authorities do it today, and they have much better control over the banking system than we do. The deposits that commercial banks have to maintain at the central bank were increased 17 times in China during the boom. And when the authorities reversed course, the banks obeyed them with alacrity. Or consider the internet boom. Alan Greenspan recognized it quite early when he spoke about irrational exuberance in 1996. But apart from his famous speech, he did nothing to avert it. He felt that reducing the money supply would have been too blunt an instrument to use, and he was right. But he could have asked the SEC to put a freeze on new share issues, because the internet boom was fueled by equity leveraging. He didn't, because that would have violated his market fundamentalist principles. Third, since markets are potentially unstable, there are systemic risks in addition to the risks affecting individual market participants. Participants may ignore these systemic risks in the belief that they can always dispose of their positions to someone else. But regulators can't ignore them, because if too many participants are on the same side, the positions can't be liquidated without creating a discontinuity or a collapse. They have to monitor the positions of the participants in order to detect potential imbalances. That means that the positions of all major market participants, including hedge funds and sovereign wealth funds, need to be monitored. Certain derivatives, like credit default swaps and knockout options, are particularly prone to create hidden imbalances. Therefore, they must be regulated and, if appropriate, restricted or forbidden. The issuing of synthetic securities needs to be subject to regulatory approval, just as ordinary securities are. Fourth, we must recognize that financial markets evolve in a one-directional, non-reversible manner. The financial authorities, in carrying out their duty of preventing the system from collapsing, have extended an implicit guarantee to all institutions that are too big to fail. Now, they can't withdraw that guarantee as long as there are institutions that are too big to fail. Therefore, they must impose regulations that will ensure that the guarantee will not be invoked. Too big to fail banks must use less leverage and accept various restrictions on how they invest the depositors' money. Deposits should not be used to finance proprietary trading. But regulators have to go even further. They must regulate the compensation packages of proprietary traders to ensure that risks and rewards are properly aligned. This may push proprietary traders out of banks into hedge funds where they properly belong. Just as oil tankers are compartmentalized in order to keep them stable, there ought to be firewalls between different markets. It's probably impractical to separate investment banking from commercial banking, as the Glass-Steagall Act of 1933 did. But there have to be internal compartments keeping proprietary trading in various markets separate from each other in order to prevent contagion. Some banks that have come to occupy quasi-monopolistic positions may have to be broken up. Finally, the Basel Accords made a mistake when they gave securities held by banks substantially lower risk ratings than regular loans. They ignored the systemic risks attached to concentrated positions in securities. This was an important factor aggravating the crisis. It has to be corrected by raising the risk ratings of securities held by banks. That will probably discourage the securitization of loans. All these measures will reduce the profitability and leverage of banks. This raises an interesting question as to timing. This is not the right time to enact permanent reforms. The financial system and the economy are very far from equilibrium, and they can't be brought back to near equilibrium conditions by a straightforward corrective move. Just as when a car is skidding, you must first turn the wheel in the direction of the skid before you correct the car. What needs to be done in the short term was exactly the opposite of what is needed in the long term. First, the credit that evaporated had to be replaced by using the only source of credit that remained credible, namely the state. That meant increasing the national debt and extending the monetary base. As the economy stabilizes, you must then shrink the monetary base as fast as credit revives. Otherwise, deflation will be replaced by the specter of inflation. We are still in the first phase of this delicate maneuver. The banks are in the process of earning their way out of a hole. To reduce their profitability now would be directly counterproductive. Regulatory reform has to await the second phase, when the money supply needs to be brought under control, and it needs to be carefully phased in so as not to disrupt the recovery. But we can't afford to forget about it. You have seen that my interpretation of financial markets, call it the theory of reflexivity, is very different from the efficient market hypothesis. Strictly speaking, neither theory is falsifiable by Popper's standards. I predicted the bursting of the super bubble in 1998. I was wrong then. So am I right now? And some proponents of the efficient market hypothesis are still defending it in the face of all the evidence. Still, there is a widespread feeling that we need a new paradigm, and I contend that my theory provides a better explanation than the available alternatives. Behavioral economics, which is gaining increased recognition, deals with only one half of reflexivity, the misinterpretations of reality, but doesn't study the pathways by which mispricing can change the fundamentals. I realize that my theory of financial markets is still very rudimentary and needs a lot more development. The pathways by which mispricing can affect the fundamentals need a lot more study. Obviously, I can't do it on my own. So I may have been premature in putting forward my theory as the new paradigm. But the efficient market hypothesis has certainly proved inadequate. That has been the entire edifice of global financial markets that has been erected on the false premise that markets can be left to their own devices has to be rebuilt from the ground up. And that concludes my today's lecture. But I would like to also want to use this occasion to make an announcement. I have decided to sponsor an Institute for New Economic Thinking, INET for short. It will be a major institution fostering research, workshops, and curricula that will develop an alternative to the prevailing paradigm. I have committed $50 million over 10 years, and I hope others will join. I also hope that reflexivity will be one of the concepts that will be explored, but clearly it should not be the only one. I recognize the potential conflict between being a protagonist and a financial sponsor at the same time. To protect against it, I want to erect a Chinese wall between me and the Institute. To this end, I will extend my financial support through the Central European University, and I will not personally participate in INET. The jury will be expressly instructed to encourage other alternatives besides the theory of reflexivity. The plan is to launch INET at a workshop on the lessons of the financial crisis at King's College, Cambridge, on April 10th and 11th. And I hope that the new economic thinking will find a home here at the CEU. Thank you very much.
I hope we may be able to elaborate a little bit more on this INET initiative during the question and answer session, if any of you would like to ask some questions about it. But I wanted to reflect in the 7 or 8 minutes that I've been given on George's broader ideas. Listening to George today, I was reminded of when we first met. It was in 1983, during the first of the bubbles he mentioned, the third world debt crisis, and was actually at the annual meeting of the World Bank and IMF. I was then a young journalist working for the Financial Times, and I just ran into him by accident. We were talking about what it was that the IMF was doing wrong in Mexico and Brazil at that time. But for me, his ideas were really a revelation, perhaps because I was so young at the time. And we became friends, and I followed the development of George's ideas closely enough to feel that I really understood them, so that when he published what I still think was his most important book, The Alchemy of Finance, I felt like an initiate into a secret religious sect. Not because I worshipped George or indeed his ideas, far from it, but because I was told at that time by almost everybody I met that George's philosophy was totally incomprehensible. The reason people bought that first book was because they thought they would pick up some investment tips. Yet I felt, to me, these concepts that he first described fully in that book of the, and that he mentioned today, of reflexivity, fallibility, and human uncertainty, and particularly the relationship between those three concepts, to me, those concepts seemed absolutely clear and revelatory. Others, as I said, differed and only bought the books for investment tips. But even though George was told initially that his ideas were incomprehensible, he continued to explain them with the combination of persistence, self-confidence, and self-criticism, which has made him so successful also as an investor. And the interesting thing now is that when he talks about reflexivity, as I think he probably did most articulately in this lecture, now everybody in the markets claims to understand reflexivity perfectly. In fact, if they couldn't understand it, they would not be able to continue in their jobs in the markets. And even in the policy-making world, among central bankers, he mentioned Mervyn King, and finance ministers, the idea that the world goes through reflexive boom-bust cycles between finance and policy is now pretty much accepted as the conventional wisdom. It's really only among academic economists that this idea is not recognized, and perhaps, although only perhaps, as George said, the development of INET will lead to its further development. But as reflexivity has now become such common ground among economists and policymakers all over the world, I want to put on, if you like, my challenging hat and actually disagree and challenge some of the ideas that George put forward today briefly. The boom-bust sequences, as George said in his lecture, can be interrupted by government intervention or other exogenous forces. And the question I want to raise is whether it's possible that the world does, in fact, tend to equilibrium, despite what we've just heard, provided the periods are long enough, and not solely through the operation of markets, but through the operation of markets interacting with government. If we take the role of government into account, is it possible that the world does actually tend to equilibrium, albeit going through fairly large cycles? In a way, this actually relates to a theory that George first discussed during that Third World Debt Crisis, which he called the Brink Theory, the idea that events push crises to the brink of complete chaos, but not quite over the brink. And this is, of course, a concept that's also been developed in the mathematical theory of complexity and chaos, where the world is always, or complex systems, are always said to be operating just on the edge of chaos. Maybe the super bubble of finance and regulation he's discussed, and indeed the even bigger super bubble of market fundamentalism and, if you like, Keynesian social democratic politics, is not, after all, a bubble, but in a sense a process of evolution. And maybe there is an equilibrating mechanism, what George called the Brink Theory, and what might be called the mechanisms of politics and democracy. In other words, maybe there is an equilibrating mechanism within politics which prevents these boom-bust cycles in market fundamentalism in economics going too far. George described how all bubbles are created by a trend and a misconception. And it's absolutely clear that the misconception, not of just of the last 2 or 3 years, but really of the last 20 years, was, as he said, that markets could totally replace politics in ordering human society. But maybe that misconception is now going to be corrected, leading to the emergence, if you like, of a new form of capitalism. And I think the key to this new form of capitalism, if it emerges, will in fact go back to George's three concepts of reflexivity, fallibility, and human uncertainty. In my view, we are perhaps moving into a fourth phase of capitalism. If you like, the first phase, 19th century capitalism, was when politics and economics were believed to be totally distinct, and both were believed to be evolving in a generally constructive direction by the conventional wisdom, or were believed to be both doomed to failure if you're a Marxist. Both economics and politics were believed to be either constructive or doomed to failure. In the 1930s, that perception changed, and from 1930s to the 70s, we went through a phase when there was a widespread belief that markets were always prone to failure and social injustice, but governments were always knowledgeable and just. In other words, the market was always wrong, the government was always right. In the 70s, there was another evolution. And from 1979, with the election of Margaret Thatcher, 1980 onwards, we went through a third stage in which the prevailing belief, if you like, the prevailing misconception, was that markets were always efficient and rational, while governments were always wrong. Now it seems to me, as a result of last year's crisis, we could be moving into a fourth stage where it is recognized that both markets and governments are fallible. Not always fallible, but frequently fallible. Now, the last point I'd like to make is a more positive one, which is that the recognition of fallibility sounds paralyzing, but actually it can be empowering. Fallibility and the recognition, the explicit recognition of human uncertainty, as George describes, creates space for change, innovation, creativity, imagination, and leadership. And it forces empiricism, self-analysis, and internal self-correction. And in my view, nobody has symbolized such creative tension between fallibility and confident self-knowledge, both in his business and his philosophical ideas, as George Soros. Thank you very much.
If I may briefly respond while people at MIT prepare their questions. You may be right, and certainly if we take that step forward and recognize that both markets and governments are fallible, liable to make mistakes, and therefore willing to correct their mistakes, we are more likely to actually develop a system which does not end in a financial crisis. However, if we make that assumption that we have reached such a system, surely there are the seeds of the next financial crisis. So you have to assume that you will not be able to do it in order to achieve it. And as you know, we've actually really extended the financial cycle by several decades through intervention. And so to that extent, the interventions were really very successful. However, then they made the bubble, when it's the super bubble, that much greater. And the great crisis of crash of 2008 was preceded by the great moderation, when risk assessments were at a minimum. So that's the contradiction, and that's the kind of awareness of reality that we need in order to maintain balance.
I would agree with you that the system can only continue if there is a systemic change, not just a marginal change. If there is a systemic change, and not just in finance, but in the whole relationship of markets and government.
That's right.
Now, whether that happens or not, as you say, very much remains to be seen. The jury is out, and in fact, perhaps the evidence is becoming less favorable to that point of view.
But actually, I will address exactly that question in my last lecture.
Yeah. Shall we now go to MIT, where we'll take the first set of questions, and then we'll move to the audience here in Budapest. Do we have a question to start with from MIT?
Yes, we have three questions prepared. Good afternoon, Mr. Soros, Mr. Kaletsky, and CEU participants. First question?
Yes, we can hear. Yes. Could you talk a bit more slowly, because then we'll hear more clearly. Do we have...
We can't hear you.
Have we lost the sound?
We have lost the sound for the moment.
Pressure mic again.
There we go.
Yes.
My name is Mark Lehrer. I'm an alumnus of MIT and a professor of management at Suffolk University in Boston. I'd like to thank Mr. Soros for a blast of fresh air and unorthodox thinking. I have a question about the role of... private incentives and compensation incentives of top managers as a possible source of distortion. I'm wondering whether that's a major or a minor factor in such crises, and whether Mr. Soros has some recommendations about how to regulate the compensation and incentives of top managers.
Well, I mentioned that institutions that are too big to fail have to submit to government regulation of salaries. And there is, at the moment, some serious, I would say, social injustice in the very large bonuses that people in those institutions earn. Because the earnings currently are due to a hidden subsidy that the banks are receiving by keeping interest rates at zero and allowing them to invest, for instance, in government bonds, 10-year bonds, yielding 3.5%. That's 3.5% free and clear hidden subsidy. This is the route that we have chosen, following the Japanese example, to allow the banks to earn their way out of a hole. And I think for the employees of the banks to then get an extra bonus on that money actually is socially unacceptable.
Another question from MIT.
Hello, my name is Amitai Kalmar. I'm a Sloan MBA student, and I want to thank you first for having this talk with us. Can you please share your views on the comments made yesterday by Professor Rubini about the status of the US dollar carry trades and the consequences which may arise when these positions will unfold? And do you think we're experiencing a new bubble evolving? Thank you.
I didn't actually read those comments, so I don't know what you are referring to. But certainly there are currently imbalances in the financial system due to the quantitative easing and the availability of free financing. So that is actually, for the moment, to the extent that the stimulus is applied in the United States, which really would need to reduce its current account deficit, the stimulus is applied in the wrong place and is building up the imbalances which were partially responsible for the crisis.
In what sense do you mean it's being applied in the wrong place, the stimulus?
Well, because to balance the world economy, the United States has been consuming significantly more, 6.5% more at the end, than it was producing. And that built up the surpluses in the other countries that and which were then invested in U.S. government bonds, and that was sort of at the root of the great moderation that preceded the storm. That's what I meant. Mm-hmm.
So you're saying the stimulus, it would be better if more stimulus were applied in other countries, in the exporting countries, in the surplus countries.
Yes, and particularly in the developing world. And as you know, I'm advocating the use of the special drawing rights for the developing world. But that would take us too far at here.
Do we have another question from MIT?
Hi, my name is Fernando Duarte, and I am a PhD candidate at MIT. And my question is, in terms of predictability of returns, what are the different implications between the efficient markets hypothesis and reflexivity?
The what?
In terms of the predictability of the crisis and of the cycle, where were the specific different points between an efficient market analysis and a reflexivity analysis, which in a sense would allow you to see, you know, which analysis was empirically better?
Well, you know, I'm not qualified to criticize the efficient market hypothesis and the rational expectations theory directly, because I'm not familiar with it. The fact that I was able to make a living for the last 50 years without being familiar with it is a comment on the value of that of those habits. However, I can tell you that my interpretation of bubbles expressly does not claim to be able to tell whether a test will be successful or not. And from personal experience, I thought the super bubble was big enough in 98 that it would lead to a collapse of the financial system, and I was wrong. So I do not claim to be able to predict the future. And I expressly claim the opposite. However, I think that with that theory, it is possible to anticipate events, to create scenarios and hypotheses that you can then test against the actual course of events. And that is, in fact, what I have been doing for the last 50 years as a market participant. Whenever I could, I formulated a hypothesis with regard to a particular stock or the market or an industry, and then I tested it against events. And when events evolved differently, I reassessed it. So I think this, and this is a very Popperian approach, and that's why I'm a great admirer of Popper's theory of scientific method, even though it doesn't apply the way he wants it to social phenomena, because of this reliance on conjectures and refutations. And it's been a very, very rewarding process as far as I'm concerned.
Well, let me press you a little bit further on that to give a specific example. If we look at this latest crisis, and I think this was really the question that was being asked, if we look at this latest crisis, could you describe for us at what point you began to develop, if you like, these a hypothesis suggesting to you that we may be moving into into a climax of a major bubble, or perhaps even the super bubble. And, you know, what were some of the events that led you either to confirm or draw back from that hypothesis?
That we may be, that was clear to me, obviously, for many years. And in my previous book in 2006, I spelled it out, and I identified, actually, the subprime and the housing market as the locus from which the crisis would come. So that was, and I was not the only one who did that. So it was visible, but when it would come could not be determined. And frankly, I and many others who expected it to happen expected it to happen at least a year earlier. Then it really started to hit in the early part of 2007, and in August, I wrote about it then and published it. That was the new paradigm, which I wrote actually at Christmas 2006, published in April. And then in August, I saw that the crisis has really arrived. And I came out of retirement and took over the management of my fund in order to protect my estate, which I did in August.
So from August 2007, it was pretty clear to you that this was going to be the major financial crisis, not just another minor bubble of the kind that we've seen over the last 20 years.
Yes, but for the order of being truthful, I did not anticipate that Lehman Brothers would be allowed to fail. I saw the crisis as being the turning point, but I did not anticipate that the authorities would fail to rescue Lehman Brothers. And I think that was a game-changing event.
Do you think, I'm sorry to take the time of our friends at MIT, but on that point of Lehman Brothers, do you think the authorities had any real alternative?
I think they did, although they would say that they did not have the powers of resolution to intervene. But in actual fact, whenever there is a crisis and the authorities recognize it as such, they took measures historically which could not be justified by the then prevailing rules. So they always used a large degree of discretion, and they could have done it had they been determined to do so.
Another question from MIT.
This is Ricardo Caballero, head of the economics department at MIT. Good afternoon, Mr. Soros. You mentioned the need to control credit in order to regulate asset bubbles, and you mentioned the example of China. But the big difference between China and the U.S. is the type of financial markets they have and we have. In China, it's mostly credit is mostly bank-mediated. The same is true in continental Europe. But in the U.S., banks play a very small role. So what do you do in a more complex financial market like the U.S. in order to control credit when an asset bubble is developing?
I'm sorry, Professor Caballero. The sound transmission was not very clear. I think I understood the question, but come back if I've misinterpreted. I think the question was that you mentioned that there's going to be a need to control credit as well as use monetary policy to regulate bubbles. And you gave China as an example of the successful control of credit. I think the question was that in China it's possible to control credit because they have a dominant banking system and almost no credit markets, and indeed the banking system is largely state-controlled. If you have a system like the U.S., which is largely a credit market securitized system, is there any feasible way of actually exercising control over credit? Yes. I think that was the question.
Yes. I think there is, And in fact, that control was being exercised, as I've mentioned in my lecture, when I started in business. The banking system was extremely closely controlled. And I actually witnessed and participated in the gradual decontrol of the banking system. In 1972, I wrote a paper entitled "The Case for Growth Banks," because I said that an industry that was totally dormant and the people working in it were not motivated by profit motive, but were more like government employees. There was a new group of banks, actually very much under the leadership of Walter Wriston of Citibank. And they fanned out from Citibank. And they actually wanted to do banking for profit. And I said this could be very rewarding for investment. And in fact, it was. And then in 73 came the oil crisis and the large surpluses that the oil-producing countries received, which were then rechanneled through the commercial banks. And that's when the London market, the Eurodollar market, suddenly came to life. And gradually, the very strict controls on state banking were overcome by setting up a London subsidiary that was exempt. And that then eventually led to the financial crisis of 82 and so on. So it is a historic process, and I actually have lived through the entire history.
But is it possible, now that the genie has been let out of the bottle, now that you have a credit market system as opposed to, or a capital market system of credit rather than a banking system of credit, yes, in the US, yes, can you control credit when it's supplied by the capital markets?
Well, obviously you can't control it as if it were within the banking system. And actually what happened was in 1982, as you recall, because that's when we first started discussing these issues, the banks were forced by the central banks to renew, roll over the credits in order to prevent a collapse. And they didn't like it. And that's actually when they started securitizing their loans so that they couldn't be caught by the central banks in case of need. And then in 97, most of the sovereign bonds had been securitized. And therefore, actually, except in the case of Korea, South Korea, the banks could not be forced to roll over the loans. And that's why the brunt of the burden was carried by the countries concerned. So it is more difficult if you don't have it in the banking system. But I think that the measures that I proposed, and I think they need to be further elaborated and refined, could actually give you that kind of the control that you need.
Should we have one more question from MIT, and then we'll go to the floor here?
Why don't we maybe hang around?
Unless there's somebody dying at MIT, we'll have some questions. I think there's someone about to ask a question.
All right.
Okay, yeah, last question.
Good afternoon, Mr. Soros. I have a question. I'm a second year student at MIT Sloan, and I want to carry on a point about China.
It's on.
Good afternoon, Mr. Soros. I'm a second year Sloan student. To carry on with the point of China, it is able to control capital inflows due to its dominant economic position in the world. How about a middle developing country? How does it do likewise? One example I think of is Malaysia, which closed up its capital inflow borders after the 1998 crisis. How does a developing country like that withstand international capital inflows?
I think the question is, again, apologies, but it didn't come through very clearly, but I think the question was about capital controls and the disruptive inflows and outflows of capital. China has capital controls, even despite the fact that it's an overwhelmingly powerful economy. I think the question was, how can other developing countries, other emerging economies, which are smaller and potentially more vulnerable, how should they cope with the problem or the threat of disruptive capital flows?
Yeah. Well, it is much easier to control capital flows when they are coming in than it is when they are going out. And you can see that Brazil just imposed a 2% tax on all new financial capital coming into Brazil in order to slow down the inflow. Now, that's a bit cruder than the more sophisticated method that Chile applies, which apportions the tax to the length of time that the capital is committed. Probably it will not slow. It will slow the inflow, but probably will not stop it. But clearly, there is a greater role for capital controls than the Washington consensus recognized prior to the crisis. Now, China has actually discovered a fabulous machine for mobilizing the creative and acquisitive energies of the people, and yet creaming off a significant portion of their productivity for the benefit of the state by tying the renminbi to the dollar and effectively ensuring that the renminbi is undervalued, so that China has built up the amount of money that has been creamed off without people feeling any pain can be measured. It's $2.3 trillion and still growing.
Very good answer. Shall we have some questions here?
Maybe we'll come back to them later.
We may come back if there's time. There's a question there in the middle. Let's start with that.
Hi, yes. My name is Zoltan Gluck. I studied philosophy at Bard, and now I'm at the sociology department here at CU. I have two related questions. I'll try and make them brief, about the nature of capitalism. One of them is about economic theory, and the other one I could say about philanthropic practice. It seems that what you're proposing here is a theory of crisis of sorts, of financial capital. And I wanted to ask about a broader field of economic theory, crisis theory, more generally, and relate it to a point brought up by Joseph Stiglitz in his lecture last week at CU. Namely that the post-war period, we saw 15 years of relative stability where there were no crises of capitalism. And that was a bit of an anomaly within the history of capitalism. I was wondering how your theory would apply more broadly historically to, say, the early capitalist crises of the 19th century. Secondly,
missed the key words, so I couldn't understand the question.
The question is, you have a theory of crises of capitalism, of financial crises. Can you relate it not just to the crises of the last 20 or 30 years, but going further back into history, into the history of 19th century of capitalism, does your theory in some sense still apply?
Yes. The big difference that in the 19th century, ever since you've had financial markets, you've had financial crises, In fact, even when you only had tulip markets, you had financial crises. But each time there was a crisis, there was an attempt to understand what went wrong and to bring some regulatory reform. And as I read the history of the 19th century, there were all kinds of commissions in England examining after each financial crisis what went wrong. And a step further was taken to build up central banking. And in the 20th century, after 1929, you started with the regulation of stock markets. So crises were followed by reforms, whereas starting in 1980, because of predominance of market fundamentalism, crises were followed by deregulation. Partly, actually, for very practical reasons, because after 1982, the banks also had to earn their way out of the hole, and it took them about 3 to 5 years to do it before eventually the emerging market debt was reorganized into Brady bonds. So there was a practical reason for doing it. But there was also this ideological reason. And don't forget that Glass-Steagall was abolished only a few years ago, and short selling on the stock exchange was abolished only just in time for bear raids.
Yes, there was a question.
The second question.
Oh, do you want to? Briefly, the second question.
Very, very brief. It's related, and perhaps could be related also to this new economic institute you're talking about. So about philanthropic practice, whether philanthropy, in your opinion, changes the nature of capitalism. That is to say, some critics have said that philanthropy sometimes acts as a band-aid, as what you've said is a fundamentally broken system. And I was wondering what you see the role of philanthropy as, whether or not it can affect a deep structural change within capitalism, or whether you see it as some type of a transition to a different type of systemic solution to some of the problems we've been experiencing.
Yes. Yes, I do think, and I will deal with that issue, particularly in the last lecture, where I deal with the international aspects, because the system was supposed to be a sort of a level playing field, but in fact the playing field was not level, and the center, particularly the United States, was more equal than others, and that brought about certain imbalances which were very much an element in the super bubble, which I didn't have time today to deal with, but I will deal with it in my fifth and my last lecture.
Question there, and then one there, and then one. No, we'll have this one, and then you.
My name is Peter Mihai. I am from the economics department of the CU. And in light of your last words, my question is a little bit premature, because you promised what to speak later on. But I saw an interesting contrast between your lecture and the subjects and the questions of the discussion after that. People were asking you about China and Malaysia and other things, so the international aspect. Can we formulate the problem in this language? Because what you presented was basically a crisis recurring according to the rules of the international financial markets, according to the rule of the American markets. But maybe actually, and in the last event, it is certainly the case that the bubble was created by real differences on the globe. The difference where China is relative to the United States, the difference where India is relative to the United States. So it's not a rule problem. It's a complexity of the world. It's globalization, where countries having really different situations play the game on the international context, and because of the communication, these things go very, very fast. Don't you think that these are probably as important element of the story, the real differences? And just a quick reference to the consequences. I think it was 2 days ago where Krugman in the New York Times was talking about the Chinese currency problem, very much in the context as you do. And then he said China was stealing jobs from elsewhere. Now, this is real thing. This is not speculation. And we cannot blame, I think, from here or from anywhere else, that the Chinese government is pursuing such a policy. It's not speculation. It's not stupidity. It's their interest.
Yes, there is obviously an international aspect to it. But let's face it. This particular crisis in 2007-2008, it originated at the center, you see. And therefore, for this particular phase of the crisis, that issue is not central. That's why I didn't deal with it today. I will deal with it at the fifth lecture. But it is a very definitely, and I think that the international system has to be rebuilt. I don't want to go into my fifth lecture now, so bear with me until then.
Now, there's a question over there. Now, there's a forest of hands going up. Lots of people want to ask questions, so can we keep the questions very short?
Brief question, and I would like to ask, don't you think that regulators would be forced to ease regulations at times of growth, and this is just a part of a natural cycle, that regulations happen after such a crisis, and then as market grow, regulators are forced by political pressure to ease market regulations that contribute later to another bubble?
The question is that once the crisis subsides, actually regulators will be forced to ease regulation by political pressures. So even if there is a slight increase in regulation in the immediate response to the crisis, an easing in the long run is likely.
Well, there already is a desire to forget about regulations because the institutions that survived, actually their market position has been greatly strengthened, and therefore they have certainly tried to protect it with all they have got, and they've got plenty. So you will have a serious issue, and I just hope that we will not forget about the reforms that are needed, because I think that the system has been very seriously weakened, and if you put Humpty Dumpty together again, it will not last.
Question over there, and maybe another one.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Soros. Bernard Bashat, Thomson Reuters, also PhD candidate myself.
Actually, sorry, can you slow down? It's hard
yes.
to understand.
So Thomson Reuters and PhD candidate Bernard Bashat. My question would relate mainly to the last question of MIT, emerging markets and bubbles. Are you not concerned that actually a new bubble is formulating in the emerging markets, let's say with the words of yours, fueled by the positive feedbacks of the increasing commodity prices, the belief that these countries has a greater potential and the carry trade operations? Thank you.
The question was about emerging markets. Don't you think that a new bubble is coming along in emerging markets, fueled by misconceptions like commodity prices will go up forever, these countries have far better prospects, you know, the rise of China and so on?
I don't think that everything is a bubble, and I do think this financial crisis, which originated at the center, has hurt the center much more than the periphery, and I do expect the emerging markets to do significantly better than the United States economy.
There was a question there.
Good afternoon, Peter Grunberg. Do you think there's scope for applying some aspects of Sharia law or ethical banking, particularly with reference to provision of credit and debt finance?
No, Sharia law?
Sharia banking.
Well, Islamic banking.
Yes.
I don't know much about it. I'm sorry.
Or ethical banking? Is there an ethical dimension to banking that could be somehow brought back? Would that be a way of controlling the banks by telling them to be more virtuous?
No, look, I'm a great promoter of ethical values, but I don't see the application in this context. And I, the impression that I have, but I really don't take this as a well-considered opinion, that the Islamic banking kind of reconciles the Islamic rules with banking through subterfuge, using some other techniques to find a compromise.
There's a couple of questions here in the middle and then one there. Thank you.
I'm Laszlo Balassi from Citibank and AmCham, so I'm one of those hated bankers. I just wanted to ask, why is it, in your opinion, Dr. Shorosh, that so little analysis is being done about the culpability of interventions like the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to enable some of these things to proceed? This is probably the only time when the people who didn't pay back the money are the good guys and the ones that didn't get it back are the bad guys. And I might be biased, obviously, in that.
The question is, the gentleman works for Citibank, so let's take that into account. The question is, why has so little analysis been done of the culpability of government intervention in creating this crisis? And the main example being Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. You know, they were supported by the government. They encouraged lending to subprime borrowers and so on. And this is the first crisis in which the people who didn't pay back the debt don't seem to bear any moral responsibility.
Well, actually, I certainly am on record blaming the regulators for failing to regulate. I mean, that was perhaps the major failure. That doesn't exempt the banks, but it certainly... regulators were as much at fault in failing to perform their duties as the banks were in exceeding their mandate.
But if I could, I'd like to press you a bit on this, because actually this is a point of view that's presented a lot in the Wall Street Journal by the Republican Party in the U.S., that actually this whole crisis was caused by the fact that markets were not free enough. It was the fact that governments intervened in markets, subsidized home loans to poor households who couldn't repay, that actually caused the crisis. What's your reaction to that argument?
I think it's very simple. If you didn't have regulations, you wouldn't have sophisticated financial markets, because they would have collapsed long ago. I mean, they didn't collapse in 98, when there was plenty of reason for it to collapse, because the regulators intervened successfully. So to argue that if you had no regulations, you would have no crises, I would say you also would have no financial markets.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Shorosh. I'm Stuart Durrant, Managing Director of the CEU Business School. And I'd like to pick up on the issue which you raised of hidden subsidies in banks, reported in the Times yesterday, I think. No surprise there. You make the point that the banks are currently taking advantage of a window of opportunity, able to earn their way out of a hole by borrowing very cheaply and investing in government bonds at 3.5% or something. What has made this possible was, to a large extent, the implementation of the quantitative easing programs, and at least the way it was presented to me was that these programs were introduced in order to make government bonds less attractive to banks and to promote the spread of credit into the economy. Is QE a failure, or do we need to try harder?
The question is, well, in a nutshell, it's whether quantitative easing is a failure, or is it responsible for this hidden subsidy?
Yeah, I know. The question is...
The question was that the reason for this subsidy to banks is that there's been all this quantitative easing, keeping short rates at zero.
Of course.
That's given the subsidy to banks. Does that mean that quantitative easing was actually a mistake?
No. No, I think that it was absolutely necessary to prevent a collapse. So the authorities did the right thing with quantitative easing. In my opinion, the mistake they made was not to recapitalize banks on a compulsory basis, but to inject these hidden subsidies to allow them to earn their way out of the hole. The injection should have been at the level of the capital, not at the level of the balance sheet, and the 700 billion of TARP money, the originally voted, would have been, in my opinion, enough to underwrite the recapitalization of the banks. In other words, the Scandinavian approach would have been more effective than the Japanese approach, because we've basically gone the Japanese route. And as you know, after 18 years, Japan is still not out of the woods.
But even if you did recapitalize them, if you give the banks money at 0% interest, what is to stop them? Why shouldn't they invest it in government bonds at 3.5% and make these large profits? Aren't you inevitably providing them with a subsidy?
Well, if the banks didn't invest at 3.5%, interest rates would not be 3.5%, but much higher. So that's part of the mechanism of quantitative easing, basically. Point is that if you recapitalize the banks, if you separated the old bank from the new bank and injected capital into a new bank and allowed the old bank to run off its portfolio, there would have been new banks which are flush with deposits and capital looking for a suitable investment opportunity or lending.
And therefore lending to the private sector,
They would have been much more ready to lend and to take risk.
Thank you. Charles Kovacs, an ex-banker in any case. While we're on the subject of the interest rates, I'd just like to note that the 0% interest rate was not necessarily charged by the government for the money given to the banks, but that is the short-term interest rate effectively paid to consumers in the United States. And that means that the demand deposits of the banks have become very cheap. This goes a long way forward. It's a lot more than just the monies that the governments have invested. On the other hand, don't you think that the lower interest rates, which affect the entire economy, are also driven by the general recession which seems to be taking place in the States? It's not necessarily just bank-driven.
Yeah, obviously, the fact that there is no private demand keeps interest rates lower than it would be otherwise. That's no question.
Could I ask you, do you believe that the bond market is in potentially a bubble? You know, you could say, well, we must look for bubbles everywhere, but do you think that long-term bonds at 3.5%, given what's happening with the fiscal deficits all over the world, that this is also a dangerously unsustainable situation?
I think that right now you're still in a deflationary environment, although the economy is recovering. And as soon as it starts recovering, if the authorities don't manage it extremely skillfully, the financial markets are going to get nervous about the prospect of inflation, and that would then push up interest rates and choke off the recovery. And that, in a way, is reminiscent of what happened in the 70s, where you had stop-go. And I think we will be in a period of prolonged stagflation, if you like, or
fears of stagflation.
But I think the financial markets themselves will prevent inflation from getting out of hand.
There was a lady there at the back.
Hello, my name is Lila Strika. I'm a registered auditor and business advisor. My question is about a book that was published in early 2009 by Harry Dent. This is an economist who was successful in predicting the major bubbles and crises that you were talking about. And in this book, he says that, apart from quoting you, that this is the end of an era. It describes quite a gloomy picture of the next few years, even decade. He says that the next Great Depression will be from 2008 to lasting to 2023, with the worst part starting late 2009, making the Dow Jones falling to 3,800 points, which will not recover until 2017. So would you like to reflect on this? Thank you.
Yes. I don't know who it is. I haven't heard the name. But I can disagree with it because, on principle, because I don't think that the future is predictable the way he's predicting it. I mean, my whole theory is that financial markets evolve in a historic process, and history is essentially unpredictable because it will depend on decisions that have not yet been taken. So how can they be predicted?
Yes, the lady over there.
My name is Cristina Butte, and I teach finance at CEU Business School. Mr. Soros, my question is, you mentioned the conglomerate mergers in the 1960s as a contributor to the bubble. My question is whether the merger wave that started in the 1980s with the strategic mergers of large companies has been contributing to the financial crisis on a longer-term level by creating large players in the market for which lenders like to lend to. Thank you.
You said that in the 1960s, the conglomerate boom, the merger mania, created a bubble. Yeah. Do you think a second round of merger mania from the 1980s onwards, which created bigger and bigger companies, which wanted to deal with bigger and bigger lenders, was also a contributor to this latest bubble?
A minor contributor. I would say that it was not a central element in the super bubble. There was this, and obviously the concentration of the financial system is much more disturbing in that respect than the concentration in the normal industry. Except, I would say, the media. But that's a different story because.
Oh, tell us about the media.
No, it has to do with the. It has to do with democracy.
We want to see if other one or two more questions from MIT. Okay, can we communicate with MIT?
Tell them we will come back to them.
We'll come back. We've got about 5 minutes left, so maybe there's time for one or two questions from MIT after we've had another question from here. Yes, sir, in the middle there. Just a moment, the microphone.
Ms. Wolfgang-Alitzky, I'm not a financial expert. I'm just a doctor and a taxpayer. And my question is, has anything what we have heard today to do with a taxpayer? The bailout has definitely something to do with a taxpayer. And is there a danger that at some point the taxpayers don't want to support this virtual system on top of them?
Yes, obviously the taxpayers are an important players in this. And they are politically objecting to the higher taxes that are implicit in the run-up of the national debt. But you have to bear in mind that there would be an alternative cost if you did not stimulate the economy. Because and you really have to look at the national debt as a percentage of the gross national product. So if the gross national product falls, you can be in a debt trap. That would be much worse than the stimulus. So it's a question of the lesser evil that you have to consider.
Right, do we have a question from MIT? No, I think we can't get through to that. One more question then from the floor here.
Jay Fogelman from the CEU Business School faculty. Mr. Soros, to pursue an earlier question, indicated, yes, that the financial system and the crisis that we're experiencing certainly has an international dimension that's related to globalization. But I'm wondering more specifically whether changes in information technology and communications technology, the internet, but much more than that, has erased geographic and cultural barriers and changed the speed of communication and has provided a glut of information, much of it highly fallible. Has this changed the function of markets just in quantitatively, or is it a difference in kind?
No, it certainly is also an element that has to be taken into account. It's not an essential ingredient for, say, explaining what is going on, but it is a contributing factor. And the element of time is extremely important, particularly at times of crisis, where you just simply don't have the time to gather all the information that would be available if you had the time to collect it. And that applies to market participants, and I can talk from personal experience and also, of course, to the regulators. And that is responsible for the increased liquidity preference that Keynes recognized and is a contributing factor in the severity or bringing on the crisis. And when you look at the incredible increase in volatility, that had to do partly with the increased speed of communications, but mainly with the much increased range of uncertainty that pervaded the market, the fear of the unknown.
This is going to be the last question. There's a gentleman there at the end.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for coming. My question would be, don't you think the biggest problem of this crisis is judging the crisis? So we talk about regulation, but the first step would be judging. And as Mr. said, this is international, pretty much international crisis. So the whole judging would be international. Who is the one? Who's the one in charge? And how? What do you think about the first step? Because you say it's a huge crisis. Other people say it's not that huge.
The question is, and I think this is a very good one to round it off with, that the biggest problem of a crisis like this is judging how serious it is, who should be in charge if it's an international crisis with international dimensions. Is there an authority there who is in charge? Is there an authority that is able to assess how serious it is? Because some people say this is the worst crisis in human history. Others say, well, it's already over. So how can you be confident that there is a regulator out there who can deal, or a set of regulators out there who can deal with crisis of this kind?
Actually, you don't have a regulator out there. And that is the challenge that confronts us. Because financial markets have been globalized, but globalization was based on a false principle that markets don't need to be regulated. Therefore, globalization and deregulation went together. And you can deregulate in a way that forces the recalcitrant countries to join the deregulation, because deregulation puts capital in a position that it can move around freely and it can escape taxation and regulation. And therefore, it will go where it is deregulated. And since capital is indispensable for the economy, countries have to compete in deregulating. But when it comes to regulating, it doesn't work the same way, because the regulation which is in existence is all based on the principle of sovereignty. And different nations have different interests. Therefore, they will regulate according to their interests. And that actually puts into place a very strong force for the disintegration of global markets through national regulation. And since a multilateral system is more efficient than a bilateral system of regulations, the challenge is how to create something which currently doesn't exist. So it's not a question of restarting the economy. It's a question of building a regulatory structure that was not created when markets were globalized.
Well, this is an exciting and it could go on much longer, but I do want to thank our very lively questioners and audience at MIT and our equally lively audience and highly interactive audience here at Central European University. We will continue this journey tomorrow when Mr. Soros will outline his concept of open society, which is in many ways the heart of what Central European University is all about. I'm very grateful to Anatol Kaletsky for so expertly guiding today's discussion, and of course, and above all, to thank George Soros for continuing to stimulate us in this extraordinary series of CEU lectures. Thank you.